You told me a bit about this. You've made quite a discovery in the world of McLuhan, we could say, or in the world of communication.
Well, we'll see.
I
would say the test of a discovery in communication is to communicate. And since I haven't cracked that nut, I would say that I'm a beginner.
Okay, but you did make this discovery, and introduce it. Tell me, do you begin with Rupert Lodge?
Oh, are you talking about the
new school
discovery of Maritime School of Communication, or what?
The Nova
I'm
Scotia
not sure what
school.
You mean by
yeah.
this discovery.
You have created a new school, the Nova Scotia School of Communication.
Well, I don't know if I've created it, but I recognize that McLuhan was very much influenced by his associations with Nova Scotia, and many of his mentors also had roots in Nova Scotia.
So lay that out. Does it begin with Rupert Lodge? Or the guy who took over the Dalhousie Review, or the guy at Acadia? Run through those three or four characters and how.
Right. So in Winnipeg, a teacher of McLuhan in English and a social friend of the McLuhan family was a guy by the name of Watson Kirkconnell.
And how do you spell that?
Kirkconnell, K-I-R-K-C-O-N-N-E-L-L.
Okay.
So if you're looking them up on the internet, I think you'll find an incredible array of books of translation that he produced, usually in association with people that spoke the language in question.
Spoke a language in question? What?
Spoke the language in question. So, for example, if you see a book by Kirkconnell about Icelandic epics, then usually he produced that work working with people that spoke Icelandic.
And it's written in English, though?
Yeah, exactly. It's a translation.
Okay, then it's Icelandic writing.
Yeah, or poetry, usually.
Okay. And he translated many different cultures, poetry.
Absolutely.
And he was in the English department. That's what people did back in those days. They were translators.
Well, but he's pretty unique in that respect.
Why?
Because nobody was looking at Canada as this multicultural mosaic in those years.
Mm.
It was largely, there was the French and there was the English, and the two were completely separate, and that's the way it was. And Kirkconnell was saying, well, wait a minute, there's many other peoples and languages and poetries in Canada than those two, and he tried to make them accessible.
And he did. He made about 50 books, you told me?
Well, I don't know exactly how many books, but did a tremendous number in all sorts of different languages. And I think what was important here was that he was a little bit of a model like McLuhan's mother. McLuhan's mother staged one woman plays where she would play all the different roles.
Yeah.
And she also did readings of many different poets. And so in all of these things, she was assuming different identities, different voices. And Kirkconnell was doing translations from all sorts of different languages. So they, what the two of them were doing was they were giving McLuhan very early on an image of the human mosaic and of the ability to go from one component of the mosaic to another. And that sort of leap and that sort of appreciation was what characterized McLuhan from start to finish.
From McLuhan's appreciation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, what years, what levels did he, was he McLuhan's teacher?
Well, I, you know, I don't know for sure that he was one of his academic teachers. I assume he was, but when I got in touch with the University of Manitoba to learn what courses McLuhan took, they wouldn't tell me.
Mm.
They said it was privileged information. Other people have told me that that's bullshit, that they a guy didn't know what he was talking about. But nonetheless, I haven't been able to isolate what courses exactly McLuhan took. What we do know is he studied with Rupert Lodge. He studied with Henry Wright, and we know this from his letters where he mentions them. He mentions a guy down the street. I forget his name, but he took Milton from a professor that lived on the same block as McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from his letters that he was personally acquainted with Kirkconnell.
Yeah, the letters show the evidence of their influence.
Correct. And not only their influence, but him being acquainted with them personally.
Right. Now, what's Kirkconnell got to do with Nova Scotia?
Right. So Kirkconnell went from the University of Manitoba to McMaster. He was a professor there of English. And from there, he became president of Acadia University in Wolfville. So I guess Kirkconnell must have been a Baptist because both McMaster and Acadia are Baptist institutions. Like Brandon University in Manitoba. So the way the university system evolved in Canada was that it was very closely associated with religion, with the Catholic religion, especially in Quebec, but also in Toronto at St. Michael's, and then in all of the institutions across Canada that St. Michael's helped to found, like Assumption in Windsor, like Sir Thomas More in Saskatoon, and I forget the name of the college in UBC, but they founded one there as well.
Who are these, the Catholics or the Baptists?
Yeah, these were Catholic institutions, but the Baptists did the same thing. They had institutions all across Canada, and the Baptist institutions were interesting in that they largely refused to be consolidated. So even though McMaster was located on the same street as University of Toronto, in Toronto on Bloor, they would not join the University of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Like the other religious colleges did, and that led to McMaster moving away to Hamilton, and the old McMaster building became the Poli Sci building. That's where Harold Innes had his office.
Okay, now what years did he become president at Acadia?
I'd have to look that up. But, he would have been the president of Acadia for something like 15 years and probably beginning in the early 60s until the late 70s would be my guess.
All right. So we have a friend, intimate friend of the McLuhans, ending up in Nova Scotia.
Correct.
And carrying his influence on McLuhan to Nova Scotia. Okay. Rupert Lodge had a connection to Nova Scotia. What was that?
Correct. So there was the Dalhousie Review was founded in 1921 by a philosophy professor by the name of Herbert Stewart. And Stewart was hired by Dalhousie, I believe, in 1913, could have been 1912, and was about to leave England for Nova Scotia when his mother got very ill.
And what was he going to do in Nova Scotia if he got there?
He was going to be a professor of philosophy.
Okay, so but nothing connects him to the Dalhousie Review, you said, started in 1921?
Yeah. So he did start it.
Oh, so he did get to Nova Scotia.
Yeah. So the very guy that started the Dalhousie Review in 1921 is the guy who couldn't take up his position in 1912 or 1913, and the guy that substituted for him for one semester was none other than Rupert Lodge, the guy who would be the single biggest influence on McLuhan at the University of Manitoba.
But Rupert, that was one of his earliest academic positions at Dalhousie.
Correct. Yeah, it may even have been his first.
Right. So he had to get into the Nova Scotia vibe to later influence McLuhan.
Well, maybe. That's one way of putting a potential there.
Yeah, and we may not have said McLuhan's mother was born in Nova Scotia. That's why we're talking
Correct.
About this. And McLuhan.
And her mother was Marshall, after whom he was named.
Yeah, last name Marshall, and Marshall born in 1911 in Edmonton.
No.
Oh,
oh yeah, born in Edmonton. I'm sorry.
Yeah. but that's just before World War One. When there was World War One, 1914, the McLuhan family moved to Nova Scotia, maybe in 1915, because McLuhan's father left the military, right?
He when he went into the military, they moved to Nova Scotia
while he was away.
I think what actually happened is that McLuhan's mother's father, even though he was in his 50s, very characteristically for him, joined the military.
Mm.
Amazing. And so did his two sons. And so McLuhan's mother's mother was left alone in Winnipeg. And so
in Halifax?
In Winnipeg.
Right,
in
Winnipeg. Right.
Yeah. So the Hall family had moved to Alberta, where the Halls and the McLuhans became acquainted, and through that, McLuhan's parents got married and had their son in Edmonton. But shortly after that, the Hall family, except for McLuhan's mother, moved to Winnipeg and started working in farms around Winnipeg. But then the father and the two sons joined the military and went overseas. So the mother was left alone in Winnipeg, and McLuhan's mother, who was also left alone because her husband had joined the military, McLuhan's mother decided to go to her mother in Winnipeg so that they all wouldn't be alone. And at that point, they decided to go to Nova Scotia because that's where the their roots were.
Right.
That's where the both the mother and McLuhan's mother still had all kinds of relatives.
And McLuhan was 3 or 4 when he went to Nova Scotia and lived there for a year or so as a young boy. Okay,
that's
the Nova Scotia roots of McLuhan himself. Now back to Rupert Lodge. He comes and teaches at Dow, and does he do anything at Dow?
Not really. It's just an amazing thing that of all the people who should have substituted for Herbert Stewart, it should have been the very guy that would prove so influential on McLuhan later.
In the 30s.
At Manitoba.
Yeah, at the University of Manitoba. Now, the third guy is Father Phelan, the mentor, or maybe there's a technical term, the guy who guided McLuhan to his Catholic conversion,
That's correct, but also did much, much more for that. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at St. Louis University. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at Assumption University. He was the guy that got McLuhan his job at St. Michael's. So McLuhan was very, very indebted to Father Phelan.
He's a major influence, maybe the most major, and yet
one of the most influential people in his life, for sure.
Right, and he grew up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as a in a French family.
Right, and went to seminary there, became a professor at St. Mary's.
The Catholic University.
That's right, and a very large Catholic university. I think it was much bigger than Dalhousie back then, and I believe it still is. So he becomes a professor, maybe even during the war, but certainly after the war. He was a professor at St. Mary's, and there were probably only a handful of philosophers in Halifax at the time. And one of them was Herbert Leslie Stewart, who was going to establish the Dalhousie Review, and one was Father Phelan. So Father Phelan, when he was the philosophy professor at St. Mary's, was also the editor of a Catholic weekly. I think it was called The Cross, but I'm not sure of that.
Right.
Phelan and Stewart were friends, and I believe it was Phelan who was able to give Stewart the technical information that he needed to start a review.
Mm.
So he needed to know, you know, where do you get the paper? How do you do the typesetting? Who does the printing? Who does the distribution? What are the costs? All of this sort of stuff. So Phelan was able to give him that kind of information. And at the same time, Stewart was giving information to Phelan because Stewart's specialty was philosophical psychology. And this would become Phelan's specialty as well.
Mm.
He would study it. He got a fellowship to study it in Europe at Louvain and other famous colleges in Europe. Where he was able to study in French. And so when he was hired at St. Michael's by Henry Carr, I believe, he was brought to St. Michael's as one of the leading Catholic philosophers in Canada. Phelan was widely published in the top journals, not just Catholic journals, top philosophy journals, and was recognized as an expert in his field, but was also a expert in what might be called Catholic communication. He recognized great minds. He recognized the potential of McLuhan. He recognized the potential of Hugh Kenner, And both of them converted to Catholicism. Both of them saw that the exercise of mind was not somehow separated from an appreciation of religion.
Right.
And Phelan was able to sort of give that sense of things to people he mentored.
As a professor of psychological or philosophical psychology or psychological philosophy?
Yeah, both, I guess.
Right. Now, the reason we're, one of the subplots is that McLuhan first published, after his student days at the University of Manitoba, I think it is his first article, is in 1936 at the Dalhousie Review in Halifax. So McLuhan's career starts in Halifax.
Correct. And he joins as a person publishing in the Dalhousie Review, he joined Kirkconnell, Lodge, and Phelan, who we've just been talking about. So they, and Stewart was their editor. So it's like we're putting together a bouquet of thinkers that are
surrounded McLuhan. They surround
That's
McLuhan.
Right.
Okay, so Phelan published at the Dalhousie Review. Rupert Lodge published there?
Yes, and he published there on the philosophy of education, which was a paper that McLuhan helped Lodge put together. And McLuhan may have played a role in getting it published at the Dalhousie Review, and that may have been one of the ways that he came to publish his article there.
Right, and you say in after the failure of the communication seminar in 55 that McLuhan sort of decided to move in by the end of the 50s into a role as a philosopher of education.
Oh, McLuhan had been known as a philosopher of education for a long time. So when McLuhan arrived at the University of Toronto in 1946, that was the last year that Eric Havelock was there.
Mm.
Although Havelock was often at Harvard that year lecturing. But Havelock was, his family was still in Toronto, and Havelock was still working at the University of Toronto at the same time that he was working at Harvard. And Havelock was known at that time as a historian and philosopher of education. So I think that McLuhan, because he was known as a philosopher of education from his thesis, was brought together with Havelock in 1946 because of their mutual specialties. And it was through Havelock that McLuhan became interested in the Appelian form.
The Appelian.
Appelian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very important for McLuhan's life.
Right. He used
now,
the Appelian method.
That's right. That's right. So then in as McLuhan was in the 1950s, as you just pointed out, he sort of took up the mantle that he had put aside in 1946 and as a philosopher of education or a theoretician of education and began to both publish in education and to go to an astonishing number of conventions and meetings where he spoke on education. The real hero in the background here is his wife, Corinne, because imagine at this time she had six children that she was dealing with. Eric was still at home. He's maybe 15, 16. And then the other five kids. And so McLuhan is traveling all over the continent, speaking at education conferences, trying to make a name for himself. And poor Corinne is home alone, dealing with all of the problems of the kids, dealing with feeding them, clothing them, all this sort of stuff. She's a real background hero in all this.
Yeah. Okay, so so we're talking about Phelan comes out of Halifax.
Kirkconnell.
Kirkconnell ends up in Nova Scotia.
Yep.
Rupert Lodge is very involved with a magazine as well as teaching there, a literary review, the Dalhousie Review. And let's see, who else do we have? Kirkconnell, Phelan, and Lodge, and then the found Stewart, who created Dalhousie Review, he's in Nova Scotia, but is there something else? Does he have a connection to McLuhan other than publishing his article, his first essay?
No,
other things.
Well, not only published his first essay, but then later, almost nobody knows that McLuhan published again in the Dalhousie Review while Stewart was still the editor. I forget exactly the year, but it was a review of a new edition of Maritain's Art and Scholasticism. We could look that up. But
right.
McLuhan obviously stayed in touch with the Dalhousie Review so that he published in it, at very different phases in his career.
Right, and McLuhan spoke several times in Nova Scotia. I know that. I know he did it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And his mother. His mother put on her plays there.
That's right. There are newspaper articles, Halifax paper reviews of her. But here's the amazing thing that you discovered is that in that issue in 1936 where McLuhan was first published was also an article by Harold Innes. Talk
Correct.
About that.
Yes. Well, it's often thought, partly because McLuhan told the story in a very distorted way, but mm-hmm. Most books on McLuhan say that he got to know Harold Innes in 1951, which is when Innes was already very sick and he would die the next year. But that's nonsense. McLuhan got to know Harold Innes personally at the latest in 1947, but maybe even in 1946 already. And he got to know Innes's work already in 1936, because when McLuhan's first article was published in the Dalhousie Review, Innes had a very important article in that same issue, and there's just no way that McLuhan would not have read that.
Right. And now Innes, he's in Toronto in the late 30s, early 40s, and Northrop Frye meets Innes before McLuhan. No, Northrop Frye meets Wyndham Lewis. I don't know if Innes ever met Wyndham Lewis, but Northrop Frye met Lewis before McLuhan did in 43. But what happened is, if you read a recent biography of Innes, he was greatly influenced by Wyndham Lewis, like McLuhan, in the 40s.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I mean,
in the biography, the author.
Not everything in all biographies is accurate. It's true that Lewis probably read Time and Western Man.
No, Innes. Innes read Time and Western Man.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who did I say?
Lewis.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, Lewis did too.
He
wrote them.
Yeah. But
so we know from quotations that Innes read Time and Western Man and The Art of Being Ruled. And almost certainly he would have read those on the recommendation of McLuhan, probably through Easterbrook. Innes had read McLuhan's 1944 article on Lewis, where he liberally quotes those two books.
Right, and we're talking about McLuhan's boyhood friend, who ends up being the top student of Innes at the University of Toronto, I guess in the 30s or after the war, 40s?
Yeah, no, he would, Easterbrook was a very close friend of McLuhan. The two of them went to Europe together in 32.
Yeah.
And then after they both graduated, Easterbrook went to study in Toronto when McLuhan went to Cambridge.
Mm.
And Easterbrook was in political economy and studied under Innes. And when he wrote his thesis in 1936, Innes arranged for it to be published by the University of Toronto Press and wrote a foreword to it. So already in the middle 30s, Innes and Easterbrook were quite close. Then when Easterbrook came back to the University of Toronto in 1947, he started working again quite closely with Innes, and by 1950, he was one of Innes's closest friends. And then from 50 to 52, when Innes died, Easterbrook was almost a personal secretary, spent a lot of time with Innes when Innes was bedridden, helped Innes finalize his last essays, and then later went on to a distinguished career in the same department where Innes had been chair. Later, Easterbrook was chair.
Right. So, now, Easterbrook was not at the University of Toronto during World War II.
No. He was at the University of Brandon. And
oh, okay.
Why he wasn't in the service, I don't know.
Right. But, now, what's interesting, here's Easterbrook, a student of Innes in the late 30s, approximately, even 1936. Innes is in the Dalhousie Review. We assume that McLuhan is letter writing, corresponding. Maybe we could check in the archives, corresponding with Easterbrook in this late 30s, 40s period. He would hear about Innes, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
During the war.
Oh, there's no question about that.
And you're saying that Innes was introduced to McLuhan by Easterbrook in 47, maybe.
That's personally.
Yeah.
But I maintain that he knew of Innes's work at the latest by 1936.
Yeah.
When that article by Innes appeared in the Dalhousie Review in the same issue as McLuhan's first essay. But, you know, McLuhan was very interested in Canadian history, and he may well have read Innes's fur trade book long before he came to the University of Toronto.
Yeah. Okay. And, a Wyndham Lewis scholar in England, Alan Mutton, discovered that George Orwell was very influenced by Lewis, leading to his 1984 book. Orwell, there's statements by him where he's puzzled and thinking a lot about Lewis. He's a little disturbed about what Lewis is noticing about media.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes great sense.
Yeah. So Lewis has had this kind of influence in a lot of scenes, and I'm saying, you don't go with me, but I'm saying he influenced two major communication scholars who are important for Innes in Canadian history, and Innes was internationally recognized. He was on the board of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, I think that's what it was, and
right.
And then McLuhan went on to be famous. So
right.
Lewis is lurking in this, and Lewis was born, guess where he was born?
Amherst.
In Nova Scotia.
Of Amherst, yeah.
Yeah, there's the Bay of Fundy that, Nova Scotia is a peninsula. So the northern part of the peninsula that on the other side is New Brunswick, you go, it's down the bay towards Newfoundland, and you'll come to the isthmus, the little connection. Is that what they call it? The isthmus is the connection of the peninsula with New Brunswick. That's where Amherst is.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's where Lewis was born. That's right.
And someone did an article on early Canadian media theorists, and Lewis was included, and I think in 1939, Canada built a communications tower that maybe went to Europe. It was an important major communications tower right there in Amherst where Lewis was born.
It could be. In the 20s and 30s, people were putting cables underneath the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
And those cables were going either from Nova Scotia or Prince Edward Island. Newfoundland at that time wasn't part of Canada.
But Marconi did, I think he did his first experiment out of Cape Breton, which is part of Nova Scotia, and then maybe he went to Newfoundland. I'm not sure, but he definitely did something in the Nova Scotia region. So the wireless comes in with Marconi out of Nova Scotia, and Lewis is there to reap the benefits a few decades later where he's born. Mm-hmm. So, wow, this is pretty, the global village, the global ESP comes out of Nova Scotia.
Well, maybe.
I mean, telegraphically, wirelessly.
A construction can be made along those lines.
What?
A construction can be made along those
lines. Yeah, the wireless is ESP, no connections. So, so we've done Kirkconnell, Phelan, Stewart, Lodge, Lewis, Innes, Dalhousie, the roots of McLuhan's family. Did we leave anybody out?
Not that I can think of, but we may find somebody later on.
Okay, so here's what happened. A major McLuhanite named...
Well, we may have left out Bob Dodds.
No, that's what I'm coming into. A major McLuhanite, a professor of English at St. Evex, St. Francis Xavier, a Catholic university in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. He started the Antigonish Review, popularized McLuhan a great deal through that magazine, was a great friend of McLuhan's, always visited Toronto at least once a year, and published a book on McLuhan. So
right.
Sanderson is the next generation of McLuhanites, so to speak.
That's right. And I forget the name of the father, the Jesuit father that was a big influence on George.
What, McSweeney? McSween?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. Good recall, Bob.
Yeah.
So I think it was him, actually, that started the Antigonish Review. And then George took it over from him. But McSweeney was also interested in McLuhan.
Right. And probably maybe drew George's attention to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wasn't it McSween? Not McSweeney.
No.
I think it's McSween or something. No?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so anybody's interested, it's McSween or McSweeney. And then the world-renowned McLuhan scholar, Bob Dobbs, had spent many years in Halifax and started going to Toronto in the late 60s and meeting McLuhan from Nova Scotia, and then eventually became McLuhan's archivist. An ambivalent position, wasn't paid, but turned out to be important for the archives that I organized it so they could be sold to Ottawa. So another part of the Halifax School. Maybe, did anybody come after me? If anybody came after me, I brought them in.
Well, Terrence Gordon.
Oh, Terrence Gordon, yes, he missed my grasp, but guess what? I knew all about his writing of the biography, the second biography of McLuhan, because a close friend of mine who visited the whole McLuhan scene with me Greg Skinner, who had a job at Dalhousie. He wasn't a professor, but he was a great friend of Terry, and I would get regular reports from Greg's conversations with Terry about how the biography was going or coming
there
along.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
So let me just think of her. So Terrence Gordon.
I don't want to put you off, but just to go back to the Annie Gunish review, you were correct that it was McSween.
Yes. I used to read his poetry. I mean, I remember him.
Yeah, yeah. And it was I was right that he established the review, and then he was succeeded as the editor-in-chief by George.
Right. Let's see. I didn't meet too many McLuhanites in Halifax. If there were any of the population, I wasn't in academia, I introduced them to McLuhan. So I was the main propagandist for McLuhan and was known for that in Halifax in the 60s and 70s. But then I moved to Toronto in 77 and then started spending a lot more time with McLuhan. But I think I had one more sentence there.
But you had been traveling up to Toronto before that, right?
Yeah, since the late 60s.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact,
you had already met lots of the McLuhan circle.
That's right. But
before 77.
I was able to drop in, and I started going to the Monday night seminars in 72, and I probably attended the most number of seminars because Eric was away often. De Kirchhoff was in and out. Logan didn't come in until 74, 75 or so. I met Logan in 75 with McLuhan. So Barry Nevitt certainly attended more than me, but he wasn't an audience. He was part of the performers. You know what I mean? He was part of the staff in a way. Let's see. I thought I had another little fact there. Moving to Toronto, really, I was able to go around to all the libraries and archives and get all the articles. And then George Thompson found out about that, and then they named me McLuhan Archivist, but I didn't find that out until after Marshall died. But here is George Thompson, who succeeded Marshall's brother as the first aide to McLuhan in the coach house. And he started about 72 or so. He ended his life visiting George Sanderson. They became great friends, and he would visit to Nova Scotia as much as he could. So George was feeling the attraction of the Halifax School of Communication, but
there
probably didn't know the impact of it, other than maybe he was interested in Nova Scotia and went up and looked at McLuhan's roots and all that, you know? Maybe that's part of the reason he went there. So I think we have established the Halifax School of Communication, and it started before the Winnipeg School of Communication.
That's right. It was, well, it in some ways it was started before, in some ways it was established after. It was a very complex growth of roots.
In both places.
I was just, but intertwined.
Yeah, I mean, I've said that a big influence on McLuhan's PhD was his mother. He was trying to understand a rhetorician. So,
well, more than that, the trivium is a series of masks, and so McLuhan's mother on stage gave a presentation of what McLuhan tried to show in history.
Yes.
Right? The taking off and putting on of different masks.
Exactly.
That's what his thesis is all about.
It's about our time, right today. I haven't had to wear a mask yet, but a lot of people are wearing masks today.
Yeah. Well, that's a mask in the particularized sense, in the literal sense.
Yes.
In the proper sense, we all do nothing but wear masks.
Ah. Okay. So If I think of anybody else I left out as we inaugurate the new website, the Halifax School of Communication.
There you go.
Well,
a lot of this is already on my website. If you search for Nova Scotia, or you search for Dalhousie, or search for Acadia, or whatever, it's all there already.
Okay, so then we could. Can you put an audio on your site?
Yes.
Well, maybe I'll excerpt this part, and you put it in there and make a little blog title, Halifax School of Communication. I mean, you started. You pretty well named the Winnipeg School, right? No, you didn't use that name.
No.
You discovered it.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. Jim in Toronto and...
They named it, but you did the research. They didn't know about Rupert Lodge and those guys, I don't think.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So, but, yeah, they... for them... it was the fact that McLuhan grew up there and went to school there, and there was an important hockey team there, et cetera.
Right, but no, you discovered the Winnipeg roots and the Winnipeg School of Communication, and you discovered the Halifax School. Now,
you did. But Jim Patterson and Rich Altman are important. Contributors to the Winnipeg School.
Yes. So you can write a blog if you want to. Did you ever write something with Winnipeg School of Communication?
Tons.
What?
I say tons.
You use that title.
Yeah, I got that's one of the links on my website goes to the Winnipeg School of Communication.
And are you giving Jim credit for naming it, or did you name it at the same time?
Oh, I don't know. I think I have some links to some of Jim's artwork, and I have links to some of Rich's film. But if you click on the Winnipeg School of Communication, I'll bet there's at least 20 or 25 posts that touch on that.
Okay. What is Edmonton claiming? Not much, right?
Well, quite a bit, actually, because at least Edmonton has bought the house that... McLuhan was born in, or if he was born in a hospital, to which he was taken back to after birth, and lived in for 3 years. And so they bought that and turned it into an art center. And then later, McLuhan got an honorary degree at the University of Alberta and gave the convocation lecture there. And... then some of the people that he worked closely with established the White Pelican there, and that was...
Watsons.
The Watsons taught there and published stuff on McLuhan and the White Pelican. And I'm trying to think, there was one other... connection to University of Alberta that has slipped my mind at the moment. But Edmonton is not totally unimportant for McLuhan, for sure. And that's where the nearly all of the McLuhan family lived in Edmonton in the, let's say, the 1920s. He had, I forget how many brothers and sisters, but maybe seven. And they all lived there except for his father.
Who had the seven brothers and sisters? His father?
McLuhan.
Marshall?
Had seven. Yeah, Marshall had was son of six or seven children.
Yeah, of McLuhan's father.
Siblings. Yeah.
No, wait a minute. McLuhan, as Morris McLuhan said, was an only child.
Yeah. So the McLuhan's father was one of a bunch of siblings. But McLuhan himself was, in Maurice's reckoning, an only child.
Yeah.
And in most people's reckoning, one of two.
Right. But so you said Marshall McLuhan had siblings. No, Marshall's father had all these siblings, and they all end
Correct.
Up living in Edmonton.
Correct.
I see.
Yeah. Sorry, I meant to say that he had uncles and aunts.
Yeah. Okay, so whatever it was I think I was going to say, I forgot, and maybe I'll think of it, but I look forward to your blog on the Halifax School of Communication. No,
All
the
right.
Nova Scotia School, not Halifax.
Nova Scotia is probably better because of the Annapolis Valley and Antigonish.
Right, and we're the first to be a non-city title. We are a provincial title. A bigger zone of influence.
Yep.
But I like the fact that Wyndham Lewis was born there. That's pretty neat.
Absolutely. We need to bring in Amherst as well.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's it. Oh, I remembered.
Okay, good, Bob.
Wait, I remembered. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Mr. McEwen at McGill University?
I don't think so, but I am aware that there's a lot of McEwens around in the academic world.
Okay. This, have you ever heard of MK Ultra?
Yes, of course.
Have you heard of the McEwen at McGill who ran the thing?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking.
And it's some of the stuff they did was horrendous.
Yeah, his name is what is this? Donald Ewan Cameron.
There you go.
Cameron McEwen is your name in reverse. Let me see if I got it right. Yeah, there he is, Donald Ewan McCameron, died in 67, and he some of his work took place in the context of the Project MKUltra program for the developing of mind control and torture techniques, psychoactive poisons, and behavior modification systems. So I had it backwards. So I was wondering if he was related to you, but no, the name is Donald Cameron. But there's something there, because I say that McLuhan exposed a larger mind control operation than the puny CIA one-on-one operation. So you're the mirror image of the puny operation. You adopted the weather level of mind control.
Yeah.
That's my part, folks. The weather.
So this guy's name was Donald Ewan Cameron, right?
Yeah. Look him up.
He was actually born in the UK, I see. So, my father was Donald McEwen, right? And McEwen just means son of Ewan, so he's Donald Ewan Cameron. My father was Donald McEwen, and I'm Cameron McEwen, right? And my father's middle name was Cameron. He was Donald Cameron McEwen.
Wow!
So
it's intertwined there, and we become our names. As McLuhan used to say. But what, so I think I had another thing I was going to start saying. So MK Ultra, now I'm going to leave it there. Great session. So I think we may have established who or what McLuhan and the Citadel of Awareness is, sort of, something, maybe not completed the Citadel of Awareness.
Yeah, it's a research project.
Right. And we need to, consciousness is a research project.
Yeah.
The Citadel of Awareness. So we might start the book next week.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to do the Taking Flight Post.
Oh yeah, we gotta do that.
But we can get through that in half an hour at the outside, so we can do that and then go to the book.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much, Cameron. Another great session.
Okay, same here, Bob.
Okay,
take care.
Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Bye.